luminous color like that of early twilight, the jerking sun became a streak of fire, a brilliant arch, in space, the moon a fainter fluctuating band. Minute by minute the white snow flashed across the world, and vanished, and was followed by the bright, brief green of spring. There is a stew simmering on a gas ring and occasionally Toby stirs it, listening to the chimes from the Salvation Army mission across the street playing Silent Night. He remembers other Christmases, the smell of pine and plum pudding and the old smell of his steam engine. He had been brought up in a three-story red brick house in a middle western town. When he was 6 years old his parents died, in the flu epidemic of 1918. After that, a series of uncles and foster parents took care of him. Nobody wanted Toby for long, though he was a beautiful boy with yellow hair and huge blue eyes like deep lakes. He made people uneasy. There was a sleepy animal quiescence about him. He never talked except in answer to a question or to express a need. His silence seemed to hold a threat or a criticism, and people didn't like it. And there was something else, Toby smelled. It was a sulfurous rank animal smell that permeated his room and drifted from his clothes. His father and mother had had the same smell about them, and they kept a number of pets, cats, raccoons, ferrets and skunks. The little people, his mother called them. Toby took the little people with him wherever he went, and his uncle John, an executive on the way up, liked big people. "John, we have to get rid of that boy. He smells like a polecat," Toby's aunt would say. "Well, Martha, perhaps there's something wrong with his glands." The uncle blushed, feeling that glands was a dirty word. Metabolism would have been much better. "That's not all. There's something in his room. Something he carries about with him. Some sort of animal. Now Martha. I tell you, John, he's evil. Did you notice the way he was looking at Mr. Norton? Like some horrible little gnome." Mr. Norton was John's boss. He had indeed been visibly discomfited by Toby's silent appraising stare. Looking back, Toby could see the twinkle of Christmas Eve ornaments. Far away his father points to Betelgeuse in the night sky. The locker room holds the silence of absent male voices like a deserted gymnasium or barracks. The boys have built a partition of beaverboard and set up their cots in this improvised room. There is a long table with initials carved in the top, folding chairs, and a few old magazines in the main room where the gas ring is located. In one corner is a withered Christmas tree that Toby pulled out of a trash can. This is part of his stage set. He is waiting for someone. He tastes the stew. It is flat and the meat is tough and stringy. He adds two bouillon cubes. Another 15 or 20 minutes. Meanwhile, he will take a shower. Naked, waiting for the water to heat up, he is examining the graffiti in the toilet cubicle, running his hands over phallic drawings with the impersonal interest of an antiquarian. He is a plant, an intrusion. He has never seen the other boys, a whiff of steaming pink flesh, snapping towels, purple bruises. He leans against the wall of the toilet as silver spots boil slowly in front of his eyes. Christmas Eve, 1923, you see the old YMCA building. Someone he carried with, hi. It's me, Toby. His father points to a few boys still staying there, the shower's silence. Other boys have gone away. Part-time in this improvised room. Building has to be vacated by the folding time machine where the gas ring is hot occasionally. Toby pulled out of the mission, stage set, other Christmases. His part is 6 years old in the epidemic. Toilet cubicle, his old face, remote parents. Sleepy animal whiff of naked flesh Christmas geese in the sky. Silent night for someone died waiting for the graffiti in 1918. If you ask for something solid as shirt and pants walks, alongside you read the monkey's paw. Years over phallic drawing snapping towels and purple bruises. Toby dresses and walks back into the living room, as they call it. A man sitting at the table. He is thin and white-haired with blue eyes. His pants and shirt are red and white striped like peppermint. A long patched coat is folded on the chair beside him. Wisps of fog drift from the lapels. "Well, Toby, and what would like for Christmas?"
"Well, sir, I guess people ask for a lot of silly things, so I'd like to ask your advice before making up my mind."
"Yes, Toby, people do ask for silly things. They want to live forever, forgetting or not knowing that forever is a time word and time is that which ends. They want power and money without submitting to the conditions under which power and money are granted. Now I'm not allowed to give advice, but sometimes I think out loud. If you ask for something solid like power or money or a long life, you are taking a sight unseen proposition. Now, if you ask for an ability, I want to learn how to travel in time. Well, you could do a lot worse. Makes you rich just incidentally. But it can be dangerous. It is necessary to travel. It is not necessary to live." Toby experienced a feeling of ether vertigo as he was pulled into a whirling black funnel. Far away, as if through a telescope, he could see someone sitting at a table, a slim youth of about 20 with yellow hair and brown eyes. A fluid plop and he was inside the youth, looking out. He was sitting in a restaurant somewhere, taste of paper-thin cutlet, cold spaghetti, and sour red wine in his mouth. The waiters looked ill-tempered and tired. Now he became aware of someone sitting at an adjacent table, so obviously looking at him that they seemed for a moment to be alone in the restaurant. It was a woman of about 26, neither well nor poorly dressed, with an older man and woman, probably her parents. She had, Toby thought, one of the most unpleasantly intrusive faces he had ever seen, set in an oily smile or rather a knowing smirking cringe with a suffocating familiarity that pressed on his being like a predatory enveloping mollusk. Toby began to feel quite faint. Suddenly he spoke without moving his lips. "You'll never get into a nice Gentile country club with a look like that hanging out of your Jew face. We like nice Jews with atom bombs and Jew jokes." Dead silence, wild-eyed faces looking for the source of this outrage. "Ach God." A Jewish waiter slumped to the floor in a faint. Toby shifted his attention to a table of blacks. "Yes, and the right kind of darka too, singing sweet and low out under the mimosa, not feeding his black face in the same restaurant with a white man and getting his strength up to rape our grandmothers. Next a table of Latin American diplomats. You greasy-assed Mexican pimps. Why don't you go back to your SYPHY Cathuzas where you belong? That's telling them," said a Southern American voice. "Go screw a mud puppy. And if there's anything worse, it's a murdering Mick with a bomb in his suitcase." A suitcase by a table of Irishmen began to tick. Toby put money on his check. He lifted his wine glass to the table of Jews. "You Jews is so warm and human. I offer to you that most beautiful of all toasts, El Haim. To life." He was moving towards the door. "You blacks got soul." As he passed the Latin Americans, he twitched his hips. "Que rica mamba. When Irish eyes are smiling." In the doorway, Toby whipped his scarf around his neck and shouted back into the room with moving his lips, so it seemed to echo from every corner. "Bugger the queen." He opened the door and heavy palpable darkness blew in with a reek of brimstone. He sprinted for the corner in a black cloud, his red scarf trailing out behind him like a burning fuse. Shouts behind him. "Breaking glass." Here was 44, Edgerton Gardens. He opened the door with his key, slid in and shut the door, leaning against it. A blast outside, sirens, words in his head, air raid. The Blitz. He felt his way to his room at the head of the stairs. As soon as he opened the door, the sound of breathing and the smell of sleep told him that someone else was there. He touched a shoulder. "Hello, I'm Jim Everson. Hope you don't mind doubling up like this." "It's all right." Toby stripped to his underwear and slid in beside him. They lay there, listening to the explosions. The bomb seemed to walk in a leisurely way up and down Brompton Road. A smell in the room,
not just of warm young flesh. It was a rank musky ozone smell, the smell of time travel. Toby woke up in a dark cottage. Mother was not back yet. He was alone and very frightened. The cottage was in Gibraltar and he knew the floor plan in the dark. He went from his room into the sitting room and looked into his mother's room. The bed was empty, as he knew it would be. The lights would not turn on. He lay down on her bed, but the fear was there as well. He went back to his room and tried to turn on the lights. None of them would turn on. Now even the light in his own room would not work. He opened the cottage door and went out. Dawn light outside, but a heavy darkness lingered inside the cottage like a black fog. He resolved not to spend another night there. Who would not spend another night there? He was two people, the boy who lived in the cottage and someone else. He saw a boat. Durban to Gibraltar. A slim youth with yellow hair and brown eyes in a blue uniform and nautical hat was the first mate. Two officers and a crew of eight on the brigantine. The boy's mother is back from the pub where she works as a barmaid. She is sprawled fully dressed on the bed in a drunken sleep. He looks around at the potted plants, a tapestry on the wall with a minaret, an ivory elephant, a glass mouse on a shelf. In the front room, a hot plate, a square yellow tea can with Chinese characters, a faucet dripping into a rusty sink. Two men are in the room, one a thin man in his 30s with a receding chin and a pasty face, and the other a priest with reddish hair and bloodshot eyes. Slowly the boy takes inventory of the sleazy decorations, a brass bowl with cattails in it on the mantle of the non-functioning fireplace, a wobbly table with a tasseled lamp, three chairs, a couch, and an army blanket. He is the boy, but also a concerned visitor, an uncle, or godfather. He is preparing to leave. Outside the cottage is a steep weed-grown slope covered with Christmas rubbish and artificial snow. He hates to leave the boy there. On the slope, a paper paddle wheel turns slowly in the wind. Written on the wheel, the missing and the dead. The priest is talking to the mother and the other man. Do be careful. And if anything goes wrong, don't hesitate to contact me. Dead fingers in smoke pointing to Gibraltar. Captain Clark welcomes you aboard. Set your watches forward an hour. British we are, British we stay. Marmalade and tea in the shops, ivory elephants, carved ivory balls one inside the other, jade trees, Indian tapestries of tigers and minarets, watches, cameras, postcards, music boxes, rusty barbed wire, signal towers. Coming in for a landing, he hears a tired gray priest voice. And how long will you be staying, Mr. Tyler? It is difficult in train A. On the train with Waring. Smell of steam, soot, and iron. The WCS are clogged with shit. Landscape of red soil, streams, ponds, and farmhouses. I have a little round box which contains a number of scenes on parchment-like paper that come alive as I turn the pages. Some oxen by a river mired in concrete up to the forelocks. Now four figures, two boys, and two girls in 18th century garb, get out of a gilded carriage. They take off their clothes, pirouetting to tinkling music box notes. In the train corridor, I encounter a French customs agent, a short heavy-set man with a red face and bloodshot green eyes, accompanied by a tall gaunt gray-faced assistant. It seems that we are passing through a tip of French Canada and he is here to examine passports. The door the agent is standing before opens towards him, but he is pushing the other way with his shoulder, his weight preventing two conductors from opening the door from the other side. At this point, he tells his assistant to break the door down with a fire axe. I intervene to point out that the door opens towards him. He has but to pull it open. This he finally does, then upbraids me and the two conductors for blocking his way. Mais je suis passenger, I protest. Quand meme. He snaps. Now the passengers all disembark from the train and line up with passports in an open-air booth. The customs agent sits behind a table against a wooden partition. Every time anyone lights a cigarette, a defense de fumer sign appears and he looks up from the table shouting, defense de fumer. I am first in line. The agent looks at my passport and sneers. Is this something of your own invention? I tell him it is something issued by the United States government. He looks at me suspiciously and says, it says here that you live in London. And so? There is a girl behind me in line holding an American passport. I point out that my passport is the same. He snatches her passport and looks at it. Then he slaps both passports down on the table and turns to his assistant. Destroy these documents. But you can't go around destroying people's passports. Are you deranged? I ask. Deranged. He sneers, turning now to the girl. Is this man your accomplice? Nothing of the sort. I never saw him before. But you travel on the same train. Well, yes, but... And sit at the same table. Well, yes, it so happened. So you admit to sitting at the same table with this man you have never seen before? And perhaps you share also the same compartment? The same bed, no doubt. It's not true. She screams. Soldiers light a wood stove. The assistant speaks, pardon me, sir, but my son is a collector. Could I keep one of these forgeries? You may keep one. Which do you prefer? Well, the girl, sir. She is prettier. My son will whack himself off looking at it, I don't mind telling you. Very well. Destroy the other passport. My passport is dropped into the wood stove. He turns to the other American passengers. All of you now come forward and surrender your lies. Documents purportedly issued by a government which ceased to exist 200 years ago. A chorus of outraged protests goes up from the passengers, but soldiers snatch their passports and dump them into the stove. Well, mother and I want you to know we will report you to the American consul, a tourist moans. The officer stands up. The currency you are carrying is of value only to a collector. I doubt if you will find one in a town of this size. He gets into the train, which starts to move. But what about our luggage? It has been impounded. You may recover it in the capital on presentation of valid passports. The train gathers speed. We are standing in a turn-of-the-century Western town, water tower, a red dirt street, station hotel and restaurant. I leave my countrymen waving credit cards and travelers' checks in front of a bland Chinese behind a counter who takes a toothpick out of his mouth, looks at the end of it, and shakes his head. I walk along the street past a saloon and barbershop and turn into a run-down weed-grown street, street of missing men. The houses on both sides look deserted. As I walk, the buildings change and the street slopes steeply down. Baths open day and night. I go into a steam room with marble benches. A boy smooth and white as alabaster beckons me and I follow him through a maze of showers and steam rooms into a waiting room and out into the street looking for a taxi on a steep stone platform over a green slope with stone steps going down. We are looking for a twin taxi. He has a twin with him who is crippled, one leg in a cast. The alabaster youth sits next to me on a stone bench. He has no white to his eyes, which are a delicate egg blue and shiny as glass. He sits there with his arm around my shoulder, talking a strange language that sets off little cartoons and film sequences, languid white legs flicker, silver buttocks in a dark room. I can take the hut set. Anywhere. I have rented a riverfront shack from someone named Camel. The river is slow and deep, half a mile wide at this point. Rotting piers along an unpaved street. Loading sheds in ruins, roofs fallen in. Standing in the middle of the street I turn now towards a row of houses. The houses are narrow and small clapboards, peeling paint, galvanized iron roofs separated by drainage ditches choked with weeds and brambles, rusty tin cans, broken stoves, pools of stagnant water running to culverts broken and blocked with refuse. I go up steep wooden steps to what had been a screened front porch. The screening is rusted through and the screen door off its hinges. I open a padlock and push the front door open. A musty smell of disuse and a sudden chill. Warm air seeps into the room behind me, and where the outside air and inside air come in contact, I see a palpable haze like heat waves. The house is about 20 feet by 8 feet. On my left is a blackened kerosene stove on a shelf attached to the wall, supported in front by two 2x4s. On the rusty burner, a blue coffee pot with a hole in the bottom. Above the stove are shelves, some dented cans of beans and tomatoes, two jars of preserved fruit covered with mold. Two chairs and a wooden bedstead at the end of the room, a step ladder by the bed. To the right of the bedstead is a door which opens onto a bathroom with two oak toilet seats side by side, a bucket black with rust, a brass faucet covered with verdigris. I go back to the street and look around. At one end, the street ends in a tributary. I walk the other way and the road turns inland. There is a shack with the sign saloon at the turning. I go in and a man with eyes the color of a gray flannel shirt looks at me and says, "What can I do for you? Where can I buy tools and supplies?" "I just rented the camel shack." "Yes, I know. Do with a bit of fixing up, I guess. Far Junction. 1 mile up the road." I thank him and start walking. Dirt road, flint chips here and there, ponds on both sides. Far Junction is a few buildings and houses, a water tower and a railroad station. The tracks are weed grown and rusty. Chickens and geese peck in the street. I go into the general store. A man with pale gray eyes and a black alpaca jacket looks up from a seat behind the counter. "What can I do for you, young man?" "Quite a few things. I've rented the camel shack." He nodded. "Do with some fixing up, I guess. It sure can. More than I can carry. You're in luck. Deliveries twice a week. Tomorrow." I walked around pointing, copper screening, tools, tacks, hinges, 2-burner kerosene stove, 5 gallons of kerosene, 10-gallon water container with spigot and stand, water barrel, cooking utensils, flour, bacon, lard, molasses, salt, pepper, sugar, coffee, tea, case each canned beans and canned tomatoes, broom, mop, bucket, wooden washtub, mattress, blankets, pillows, knapsack, bedroll, slicker, machete, hunting knife, 6 jackknives. The proprietor walks behind me writing the purchases down on a clipboard. "Alligator Gladstone bag? $15. Why not? Jeans, shirts, socks, bandanas, underwear, shorts, pair extra walking boots, shaving kit, toothbrush." I pack the clothes and toilet articles into the bag, fish hooks, leaders, sinkers, lines, floats, minnow seine. Now for the guns. Colt Frontier 6-inch barrel 32 to 20 caliber, a snub-nosed 38. Inside belt holster, this I pack in the bag, double barrel 12-gauge shotgun. I look at the lever-action rifles. It would be handy to have a 32 to 20. Same shells for pistol and rifle. Anything around here need a heavier load? Yep. Bear. It isn't often a bear attacks. When he does, this he tapped a box of 32 to 20 shells would just aggravate him. He paused and his face darkened. Something else needs a heavier load and longer range. What's that? Folk across the river. I picked up the Colt 32 to 20 and holster. Any law against packing a gun in this town? There's no law in this town, son. Nearest sheriff is 20 miles from here and keeps his distance. I loaded the gun and strapped it on. I picked up the Gladstone bag. How much do I owe you? He calculated rapidly. $200.40 plus a $2 delivery charge. Sorry about that. Things keep going up. I paid him. Much obliged. Delivery buckboard leaves at 8 tomorrow morning. Best get here a bit early. Likely think of a few more things you'll need. Any place to stay here? Yep. Saloon hotel 3 doors down. Drugstore next door. Old Chinese behind the counter. I bought tincture of iodine, shaving lotion, permanganate crystals for snake bite, a tourniquet, a scalpel, a 5-ounce bottle of opium tincture, a 5-ounce bottle of cannabis extract. Saloon Hotel. The bartender had russet hair and a face the same color. A calm, slow way about him. Two drummers at the bar drinking whiskey, talking about the rising wholesale cost of fencing. One fat and clean-shaven, one thin with a carefully trimmed beard. Both of them looking like they stepped out of an old photo album. Poker game in one corner. I buy half a pint of whiskey and a stein of beer and carry them to a table. I measure myself some cannabis extract and wash it down with whiskey. I pour myself another shot, sit back and look around. A boy turns from the bar and looks at me. He is about 20 with a wide face, eyes far apart, dark hair and flaring ears. He has a gun at his hip. He gives me a wide sunlit grin and I push a chair out with one foot. He carries a glass of beer over and sits down. We shake hands. I'm Noah. I'm Guy. I hold up the bottle of cannabis extract. Want some? He reads the label and nods. I measure it out and he drinks it with a splash of beer. I fill two glasses with whiskey. I hear you rented the camel shack on the river, he says, wriggling his ears. That's right. Could you do with some help fixing it up? I sure could. We drink in silence. Frogs croaking outside. It's dark when the bottle is finished. I call to the bartender. Got anything to eat? Passenger pigeon with cornbread, hominy grits, and fried apples. Two orders. He steps to the end of the bar and taps on a green panel. The panel opens and the Chinese from the drugstore looks out. Bartender gives him the order. When the food comes, we eat ravenously. Time travel makes you hungry. After dinner we sit, observing each other with impersonal attention. I can feel the chill of silent space and a second we are breath in the air. One of the drummers shivers and looks around at us, then turns hastily back to his whiskey. Shall we take a room? I ask. I've got one already. I pick up my bag. The bartender hands him a heavy brass key. Number 6, second floor. He goes in first and lights a kerosene lamp on a table by the bed. Room contains a double bed with brass bedstand, faded rose wallpaper, a wardrobe, two chairs, copper luster washstand and pitcher. I see a Gladstone bag like mine, but this one has seen a lot of wear. Travel stained, the stains unfamiliar. We take off our guns and hang them on the bedstead. What caliber? I ask. 32-20. Same here. I point to a rifle in one corner, 30-30. He nods. We sit down on the bed and take off our boots and socks. Smell of feet and leather and swamp water. I'm tired, I say. Think I'll turn in. Me too. I've come a long way. He blows out the kerosene lamp. Moonlight streams through the side window. Frogs croak. An owl hoots. A dog barks in the distance. We take off our shirts and pants and hang them on wooden pegs. He turns towards me, his shorts sticking out at the fly. That stuff makes me hot, he says. Shall we camel? When I wake up, sunlight is streaming in the front window. We get up, wash and dress and go down to the bar for a breakfast of ham and eggs, corn muffins and coffee. We walk up to the store, where a youth of 15 or 16 is loading the buckboard. He turns and holds out his hand. I'm Steve Ellisor. Noah Blake. Guy Starr. The boy wears a cold frontier at his hip. 32-20. He nods. He has russet hair and skin the same color. I figure he must be the son of the saloon keeper. I go into the store and buy a slicker, mess kit and bedroll for Guy, a two-man tent, a can of white paint with three brushes, a bushel of apples, corn on cob and three stools. We give the Ellisor boy a hand loading the gear, climb in back and sit on the stools. The boy takes the reins and we move off down the road. When we come to the turn, the boy points to the saloon. Get some bad hombres in there sometimes. Not that he wants their custom. They come anyway looking for trouble. I remember the pale gray eyes of the saloon keeper and wonder if he is related to the store owner in Far Junction.
Yep, the boy says, reading my mind, brothers. Only two families hereabouts, the Bradfords and the Ellisors. Except for those who come in from outside. Anybody else on the riverfront?
Two Irish and a girl, if you could call her that, and house by the inlet. Expecting more visitors in a few weeks.
These bad hombres you mentioned.
Where they come from?
Across the river.
He points.
I can make out the outlines of a town through the morning river mist. When the fog lifts, you can see their fucking church sticking up.
The boy spits.
He stops in front of my shack. I could help you fix the place up, just one delivery to make down the road.
Sure.
We could do with some help.
Would a dollar be too much?
Sure not.
All right.
I'll drop the gear off and be right back.
Guy and I get out with broom, mop, bucket, carbolic solution and wash rags.
Guy goes to river with bucket.
Up steps, new hinges for screen doors, new screening for door and front porch.
Unlock door which is heavy oak.
Heave old stove into brambles followed by coffee pot, bean and tomato cans, preserves.
Guy is back with a bucket of water into which he pours carbolic.
He is mopping up bathroom and cleaning toilets while I sweep.
Under the dust the floor is yellow pine in good condition.
Yellow pine paneling on walls and ceiling, trapdoor leads to attic.
Guy is cleaning table and shelves when the Ellisor boy returns with buckboard.
Boy unhitches horses and hobbles the strawberry roan.
Next to unload in sequence.
We don't talk, we know what to do.
Water container by stove.
Fill container from 2 5-gallon cans.
Fill boiler with river water.
New stove on table.
Fill stove with kerosene.
Fill burner under boiler with kerosene, put in new wick.
Groceries and cooking utensils on shelves and stove and nails.
Mattress and blankets on walnut bedstead.
Trunks along wall, bedclothes packed in trunks, Gladstone bags out of the way in the attic.
We take off our shirts.
Steve's body is red-brown like his face.
Guy's body also tanned but tanned in overlaid blotches like dab painting.
Star 10, he tells me.
Steve and Guy start screening the porch.
I take ladder outside and scrape the walls for paint.
Old paint comes off easy.
One wall scraped.
Screen door on hinges, porch half screened.
Time for lunch.
Lemonade, apples, flapjacks.
Screening finished on porch.
New screen for the two side windows.
Scraping.
Painting.
No wasted movements, no getting in each other's way, no talking.
Time laid out in screening, painting, putting things away in trunks, storing cases of food and ammunition in attic.
At 4 o'clock we are looking at a neat house, white and shining like a ship in the afternoon sun.
I mix a copper luster pitcher of lemonade.
We go out and sit on the porch steps.
There it is in the afternoon sun, a white church steeple with a gold cross on top.
I can see the mean pinched hate-filled faces of decent church-going women and lawmen with nigger notches on their guns.
Steve retrieves the bean and tomato cans I have thrown away and puts them up on a beam of the loading shed about 35 feet from the porch steps.
He walks back towards us, pivots in a crouch, draws, aims, and fires, gun held in both hands and extended at eye level.
Splat!
A tomato can explodes, dripping tomato juice down the beam.
Steve sits down.
Guy stands up, draws, and aims and fires.
Splat!
Bean can explodes.
I stand up, arms relaxed, both eyes open.
Look at target.
See bullet hit.
Release draw mechanism.
Gun jumps into my hand.
Splat!
We fire 6 rounds each and reload.
Smell of black powder, smoke, beans, and tomatoes.
Steve gets a shovel from the porch corner, walks around by side of house tapping ground with his feet. He stops and digs, fills can with earth and thick red worms. We get three lines on spools with hook, leader, float. Guy and I take our 30 to 30s. We walk down road to the tributary, which is about 40 feet wide at junction with river. As we pass the end house, I see three people sitting on the porch, which is overgrown with vines. A dark Irish boy grins and waves. Sitting on either side of him are a boy and girl, obviously twins. They both have casks of bright orange hair and blank and human expressions. They wear green shirts and pants and yellow shoes. They look at us, faces twitching. Across the inlet, the road continues overgrown with weeds and bushes. I start to take out my line. The boy shakes his head. Catfish here. He leads the way along a path through undergrowth by the inlet. A water moccasin thick as my arm slides into the water. Here. We stop by a deep blue pool, bait hooks and drop lines in. In a few seconds, floats are jerked down out of sight and we are pulling out bass and jack salmon. We are cleaning the fish when I hear a deep growl. We turn, picking up 30 to 30s. 20 feet away, a huge grizzly stands on its hind legs, teeth bared. Cock guns. Click. Click. Steve slides his Colt out. We freeze and wait. The bear drops to all fours, growls and lumbers away. As we pass the end house, I see that there is no one on the porch, but the door is open. I call from the road. Want a fish? The dark youth comes to the door naked with a hard on. Sure. I toss him a 3-pound bass. He catches it and goes back inside, and I hear the fish slap flesh and then a sound neither animal nor human. Strange folk. Where they come from? Guy points to the evening star in a clear pale green sky. Venusians, he says matter-of-factly. The twins don't speak English. You speak Venusian. Enough to get by. They don't talk with the mouth. They talk with the whole body. It gives you a funny feeling. We light kerosene lamps, cut boneless steaks off two jack salmon. While the fish cooks, Guy and I drink whiskey and lemonade. There is a hinge table with folding legs attached to the wall opposite the stove. We sit on stools, eating the jack salmon, which is perhaps the best pan fish in the world if you prefer the more delicate flavor of freshwater fish. We sit on the porch in the moonlight looking across the river. Be all right if they stayed there and minded their own business, Steve said. Ever hear about smallpox minding its own business? Guy asks. The boy slept between us light as a shadow. Thunder at dawn. Have to get started. The road floods out. Smell of rain on horse flesh. The boy in a yellow slicker and black Stetson waves to us and whips the horse to a trot as rain sluices down in a gray wall. We make a pot of coffee and sit down at the table. We sit there for an hour without saying anything. I am looking at two empty stools. Going zero, we call it. A gust of wind knocks at the door. I open the door and there on the porch is the boy with orange hair from end house. He is wearing a slicker and carrying a gallon can. He points to a 5-gallon can of kerosene in a corner of the porch. I get a funnel and fill his can. Inside. Coffee. He steps warily into the room like a strange cat and I feel a shock of alien contact. He twitches his face into a smile and jerks a thumb at his chest. Pat. He ejaculates the name from his stomach. He throws open his slicker. He is naked except for boots and a black Stetson. He has a hard-on straight up against his stomach. He turns bright red all over, even his teeth and nails, an idiot demon from some alien hell, raw, skinned, exposed, abandoned yet joyless and painful, like a prisoner holding up his monocles, or a leper showing his sores. A musky rotten smell steams off him and fills the room. I know that he is trying to show us something and this is his only way to communicate. The words of Captain Mission came back to me. We offer refuge to all people everywhere who suffer under the tyranny of governments. I wondered what tyranny had led him to leave his native planet and take refuge under the Articles. The rain stopped in the late afternoon and we walked down to the inlet in a gray twilight and shot two wood pigeons from a dripping tree. A sharp sickening smell. In the middle of a red carpeted room I see a plot of ground about 6 feet square where strange bulbous plants are growing. Centipedes are crawling among limestone rocks and from under a rock protrudes the head of a huge centipede. I arm myself with a cutlass and someone I can't see clearly picks up a piece of firewood. I kick the rock over but the centipede digs deeper and I can see that it is huge, perhaps 3 feet long. Now it is under my bed and I wake up screaming. I know that I must make preparations for a war I thought had ended. Please to use studio. Postulated to you. We arrive at BA Dan around midnight local time. The space front is stacked with garbage under sputtering blue arc lights. Garbage collectors strike. Someone is always on strike in BA Dan. Smugglers of every variety are moored at BA Dan. The skippers all get together at the annual skipper party and award a gold cup to the all-around vilest skipper of the year. Skipper Krupp von Nordenhals will win hands down. There are also cops of every variety making deals with the skippers and arresting anyone who doesn't have the fix in. We hail a cab. Where's the action here, Pops? Wall, I reckon you boys want to go to Fun City. Better pick some artillery first. He stops at a neon-lighted all-night gun shop. The shopkeeper has all the old Western models and some of the new-fangled double-action 38s. These guns shoot an afro charge that can disable or kill. Neck and heart shots are fatal, stomach, solar plexus and genital hits are knockabout shots. Audrey selects a snub-nosed 38 in a quick-draw holster. PU slips a 41. Derringer into his vest pocket and straps on a Smith & Wesson 44. It's a much better load than the 45, old sports. Fun City is on a plateau that falls steeply on one side down to the river that separates BA Dan from Yaswata. On this slope is a vast caspa. The houses are connected by catwalks, trapdoors, and tunnels that contains the largest per capita criminal population ever seen anywhere. BA Dan breaks a lot of records. We walk into a leather bar called the Stretch Nest. A goodly crowd is there. 4 feet deep at the bar, waiting in line for openings at the gambling tables, going up the wide red carpeted stairs to private hanging rooms followed by waiters with trays of drinks and buckets of champagne. The usual costume is boot and chaps, bare ass, and crotch. Some have tight-fitting chamois pants up to mid-thigh and shirts that come to the navel. Many are naked except for boots, gun belts, and hang noose scarves. Nooses dangle every 10 feet from a beam down the center of the room. A hangfist fight draws a circle of cheering onlookers, as two kids smash each other in the face, lips cut, eyes black, noses broken, spurting blood. One kid is down. He tries to get up and falls on his side. The winner bends down and ties his arms with a noose scarf. Next thing, the kid is hanged and his semen spatters the bar. The bartender wipes it off with his bar rag. Now an old rooster, strapped into his corsets, comes in a gunning for some kids to hang at his debutante daughter's coming out party. He settles on PU who has seen him a coming and has the derringer palmed. Fill your hand, you young varmint, the old gun drawls. PU shoots him in the neck with the derringer and he falls farting and shitting, the corsets bursting off him. Lucky thing he had his clothes on, old sports. A naked 15-year-old sticks his head in the bar. The Clantons and the Earps is shooting it out at the OK Corral. A great bestial hoop goes up from the bar. The patrons shove and jostle out past hanged corpses, slipping in sperm. And they head for the OK Corral. There it is right beside it, a gallows that can service 13 at a time. The Clantons and the Earps walk towards each other, naked except for gun belts and boots, meeting cock to cock. You boys have been looking for a fight. Wyatt draws. Now we aim to give it to you. He draws and gets Billy Clanton in the crotch. Billy sags but he knocks Wyatt out with a solar plexus shot from the ground. Doc Holliday turns sideways, but Ike Clanton circles and gets him right in his skinny ass. Virgil and Guy Earp are down. The Clantons have won. The Earps and Doc Holliday are hanged simultaneously. The crowd goes hanging mad. Gunfights all up and down the street, people sniping from windows and doorways, casting from rooftops with deep-sea fishing gear and nooses, trying to snag someone off the street. They are lined up at the gallows. Ropes are unslung and bodies thrown aside, some of them still alive, strangled by street boys or picked up by roving buzzard bands. People hang from balconies, trees, and poles. Even horses are hauled into the air, kicking and farting, while boys prance around them, showing their teeth in mimicry. The culmination of this loutish scene is now at hand as drunken cowpokes drag screaming whores out of the cathusas. "You've given me your last dose, you rotten slut. My God, they're hanging women." Audrey gasps. "Enough to turn a man to stone," drawls Captain Strobe. "Let's get out of here." Six youths in chaps bar the way. "In a hurry, stranger?" "Yes," says Audrey, and he kills him with a neck shot. He flops against another boy, deflecting his aim. Audrey and PU are unbelievable with handguns. They boys are all down now or dead. We walk away and leave them, fair game for any roving band of vigilantes. Before we turn a corner, they are seized by the Hanging Fathers naked except for their clerical collars. The Hanging Fathers represent one of the sects under the control of the Council of the Selected. They are one of the most powerful organizations in Badan. We stroll along to the amusement park section. Here are the elevators, parachute, and roller coaster gallows and all variations of hanging roulette. From Russia with Love is played like Russian roulette. You stand on the trap with the rope around your neck and you get a gun with one live load. You spin the cylinder and then, instead of putting the gun to your own head, you aim at someone in the audience. If you can draw an audience or anyone within range and if it's the live shell, the shot springs the release. Or maybe some yokel throws a firecracker under the gallows. They'll work up to an atom bomb eventually. Now the wall of a building flies up and there are 13 commies hard at it, and we take off across the park, bullets whistling all around us. We duck behind the elevator gallows building 10 stories, 300 feet long. You start at the 10th floor with a rope around your neck and drop down at express speed, and when the elevator stops a panel flips open and you get popped. And, of course, you can play roulette on the elevators, any odds you want. Audrey is getting that weak feeling it's the wet dream of his adolescence, going down very fast in an elevator that suddenly stops. He didn't know what it meant then. Now he just has to try it. So up to the 10th floor. A red carpeted corridor runs the length of the building. On one side a Turkish bath, on the other the elevators, green lights showing when the elevator is vacant. Youths, draped in towels or naked, come out of the showers and steam room to importune in the hall. Audrey beckons imperiously to an attendant, "Do you have a well-equipped think room?"
"Oh yes, sir."
"Right this way, sir." "Very sensible of you, sir, if you don't mind me saying so, sir." The youths mutter angrily. "Come up here for a free feel. Hombre Conejo. Fucking rabbit man." Inside the think room, the boys put on helmets. There are dials and screens. You can call your shots. Will it be an open elevator? The moon is full. The lights of Yaswada twinkle across the bay. Audrey could throw a potent curse. Or something with mirrors and video cameras, home movies to show his friends when he has a comfortable little bungalow in a nice residential district of Badan. Everything is permitted in a think room, so Audrey simply lets himself go. An open elevator or a mirror job? Why not both, one after the other? Pop. 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 He is spattering death all over Yaswada across the bay. Now he reaches out for the hermaphrodites and transplants of Yaswada. Two of these creatures undulate in, trilling. You know what happens now, don't you, Audrey? Jerry's head is on the body of a red-haired girl and her head is on his body, long red hair down to his nipples. Audrey gets the Gorgon queasies at the sight of them.
We're going to pop you, Audrey. An open elevator for this one.
Here you go. Her hair blows up around her head like flames from hell.
Pop.
Audrey is learning to relax and throw his pops. A fire starts in a warehouse across the bay. Now for the Big Dipper, which towers 800 feet into the night sky, all lit up with twinkling stars.
Biggest and fastest roller coaster in the solar system.
Like I say, BA Dan breaks a lot of records.
Audrey stops in a little cafe he just remembers, up this little street and turn right, they sit under an arbor and order mint tea and all take a whopping dose of itchy tingles.
You chaps just back up my play.
Give me all your itchy tingle prana when I pop.
Sure thing, old sport.
Audrey remembers a very exclusive little shop you don't get through the door or even find the door unless the proprietor likes your looks.
Audrey knows him from Mexico City where Audrey was a private eye in another incarnation.
Inside the shop, he buys winged mercury sandals and a helmet with wings from a whooping crane.
He tops off the ensemble with a silver wand.
They take a private car on the Big Dipper.
Audrey stands with a silver silk noose around his neck, feet apart, knees bent, riding the dips, the wand moving in front of him.
Up they go now, up, 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 up. Audrey is getting a hard on, a dizzy pause, and now, the Big Dipper comes down, 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 and levels off.
Audrey extends his arm and the wand tingles straight for the power plant of Yaswada.
POP.
All the lights in Yaswada go out.
A lecture is being given.
Jimmy Lee is checking dials.
We better get out of here fast before they get our range.
We walk over to the shooting galleries and penny arcades on the edge of the plateau.
A high electric fence separates Fun City from the vast slum area in BA Dan that stretches down to the river and extends along the river's banks.
It is 3 a.m., a warm electric night, violet haze in the air and the smell of sewage and Coleman lanterns.
The pitchmen wear pink shirts, striped pants, and sleeve garters.
They have gray night faces, cold eyes, and smooth patter.
One of the shills with a Cockney accent and a thin red acne-scarred face, standing in front of a curtained booth, makes a gesture that is unmistakably obscene and at the same time incomprehensible.
Audrey is reminded of an incident from his early adolescence down on Market Street, brass knucks and crooked dice in pawn shop windows and a smooth high yellow pitchman trying to talk him into a museum, as he called it.
Shows all kind masturbation and self-abuse.
Young boys need it special.
Audrey does not exactly understand what the man is talking about.
He turns and walks abruptly away.
The mocking voice of the pitchman follows him.
Hasta luego, amigo.
We walk on and stop in an all-night restaurant where an old Chinese serves us chili and coffee.
He puts a closed sign on the front door and locks it.
Out this way.
He shows us out the back door into a weed-grown alley by the fence.
Frogs are croaking and the first light of dawn mixes with the red sky.
A boy pads up beside us silent as a cat.
You come with me, mister.
Somebody want to talk you.
The boy has a straw-colored face dusted with orange freckles, kinky red hair, and lustrous brown eyes.
He is barefooted and dressed in khaki shorts and shirt.
We walk along beside the fence.
Here.
The boy pulls aside a piece of tar paper.
A little green snake slides away.
Under the paper is a rusty iron panel set in concrete.
We go down a ladder and through a winding passage that smells of sewage and coal gas, out into a narrow street that looks like Algiers of Morocco.
The boy suddenly stops, sniffing like a dog.
In here, quick.
He guides us into a doorway, upstairs, and a ladder onto a roof.
Looking down, we see a patrol of six soldiers with machine guns checking every doorway on the street.
Audrey studies the gray faces and cold fishy eyes of the soldiers.
Junkies.
Fucking heroids, the boy spits.
The boy guides them through a maze of roofs and catwalks down a skylight, finally stopping in front of a metal door.
He takes a little disc from his coat pocket. The disc bleeps faintly and the door opens. A Chinese youth stands there. He is wearing a pistol in a holster at his belt. It is a bare room with a table, chairs, a gun rack, and a large map on one wall. A man turns from the map. It is Dimitri.
Ah, Mr. Snide, or should I say Audrey Carsons, so glad to see you again.
We shake hands. And your young assistant as well. He shakes hands with Jimmy Lee. Both somewhat altered but none the worse for wear. We introduce the others. You are welcome, gentlemen, and now, there is much to explain. He stands before the map with a long thin hazel stick in his hand. We are here. He circles the area below the plateau of Fun City down along the Ba Dan riverfront. It is known as the Kasba. Outlaws and criminals of all times and places are to be found here. The area is heavily patrolled and the soldiers, as you have observed, are all heroin addicts. Their addiction conveys immunity to the fever and assures absolute loyalty to their masters who, of course, supply them, extra rations for arrests. Rations cut for any dereliction of duty. It's neat, I put in. But couldn't they buy it somewhere else? No, they could not. We control the black market. No pusher would serve them unless he is tired of living. But why not? If they can get it someplace else, that breaks the monopoly. We have other plans which you will learn in good time. Dimitri was giving a lecture accompanied by slides and moving films. Ba Dan is the oldest spaceport on planet Earth and like many port towns has accreted over the centuries the worst features of many times and places. Riffraff and misfits from every corner of the galaxy have jumped ship here or emigrated to engage in various pernicious and parasitic occupations, swelling the ranks of brothel keepers, whores, pimps, swindlers, black market operators, go-betweens and fixers. The class and occupational structure is compartmentalized like an Arab city. Blue twilight was filling the narrow twisting alleys of the city. The stranger shivered, gathering his ragged cloak about him. Lights were going on behind latticed windows. Here and there blue street lights sputtered in sockets. A beggar crawled into the street, barring his way and holding forth a bowl fixed into the stump of his arm like a ladle. His legs were twisted, limp and boneless, his shaven head was fetal, his lips parted with a fetid yellow exhalation of breath. The stranger stepped by him and the beggar muttered curses in a gurgling liquid dialect that seemed to bubble up from noisome depths. The stranger felt as if he were being pelted with filth, the words sticking to the back of his cloak with a vile stench. Just ahead was a stone stairway, half a house high, stained with garbage and phosphorescent excrement. Beyond he could see a misty, blue-lit square. As he stepped into the square, which was littered with rubble half buried in sand, he found himself surrounded by a gang of filthy youths about 4 or 5 feet in height, mewling and chittering and chirruping among themselves as they moved closer to blocking his way and sidling in behind him. At first glance in the blue light and drifting wisps of fog the boys appeared simply as ragged hungry waifs bent on extorting what money they could from a stranger. Looking closer, he saw that they were all in some way inhuman. Some had long red hair and sputtering green eyes and their hands were armed with needle claws dripping fluid in the blue light. They were wearing leather jock straps and short fur cloaks that gave off a rank smell of stale sweat and half-cured skins that billowed around them as they moved. He noted that the inside of their cloaks was faintly phosphorescent and surmised that the skins had been cured by rubbing in the phosphorescent excrement that littered the streets. The boys hissed through sharp yellow teeth with snarling smiles as the hair stood up on their heads and legs, bristling like animals. Others, completely naked despite the cold, had smooth reptilian skins, crystal dark eyes and long flexible tails tipped with points of translucent pink crystal. They swung the tails up between their legs pointing at the stranger with mocking bumps and grinds as they hissed in simulated ecstasies. Other boys had crystal fingertips, which they drew out to needles, clicking them together like tuning forks to little rhythms that set his teeth on edge. The boys drew closer. Why do you block my path? I am a stranger who would pass in pass. One boy stepped forward and bowed so that his long red hair brushed the stranger's boots in a gesture of mock servility. "A thousand pardons, O nobly born. But he who would pass here must pay the price of passing. This is reasonable, is it not?" As the boy straightened up, he grabbed the bottom hem of the stranger's cloak and, leaping high in the air with a shrill animal cry, pitched the cloak up over the stranger's head. The other boys imitate his cry and wave